Hello, this is Terrence McNally. This week I share with you my 2013 interview with Hazel Henderson. As a mom in New York in the early 60s who'd never been to college, Hazel got upset about pollution threatening her young child, became an activist, and developed into a global expert and author on economics and sustainability. She passed away May 22nd at the age of 89. Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome again to Free Forum. As we begin a new year, let's step back and look at where we are in the big picture. What are the most critical issues facing the U.S. and the world? And how do you see things moving in those areas? And how are things getting worse or better? And what should we be keeping our eyes on in the year to come? My guest for today's conversation will be Hazel Henderson, a woman who's been asking these sorts of questions for at least the last 40 years. We're going to approach this exploration globally as well as nationally with a long-term view and with an eye toward relationships and systems that we often miss, perhaps, in our day-to-day focus on the latest news and events. Now, if this introduction sounds familiar, it's because this was my plan a few weeks ago when Hazel was my guest. But we ended up spending so much time on her journey, and it's a remarkable journey. A mom in New York who'd never been to college, got upset about pollution in the early 60s, I think, and she felt that the pollution was threatening a young child. She became an activist, and within a few years, she developed into a global expert on economics and sustainability, the role that she still fills today. And today, we're going to have Hazel on again, and we're going to jump past that and get into these larger questions. Here in Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Hazel Henderson is the founder of Ethical Markets Media, the creator and co-executive producer of its TV series. She's a futurist, an evolutionary economist, a globally syndicated columnist, and a consultant on sustainable development. The first version of her Country Future Indicators, an alternative to the gross national product, is a co-venture with Calvert Group, the Calvert Henderson Quality of Life Indicators. Henderson is author of 10 books, including Building a Win-Win World, Life Beyond Global Economic Warfare, Ethical Markets, Growing the Green Economy, and her upcoming Mapping the Global Transition to the Solar Age. Welcome back to Free Forum, Hazel Henderson.
Thank you, Terrence. Looking forward to this.
Okay, so as you know, the first question, which as I said last time, we just ended up going on and taking this tangent and that tangent, and I got a lot of feedback. People loved the show, but we didn't get to that second part I'd sort of promised. But I do, for people who didn't hear that show, I do want listeners to get a bit of a feel for you, the woman behind the ideas and the work that we're going to talk about. So briefly, in your own words, just a bit about that path that I hinted at. And
okay.
This will be the brief
version.
All right,
but don't let me rattle on. Right?
I won't. Okay. I'll have my rattle monitor on.
All right. Well, basically, I grew up in Britain, and I was lucky enough to have a mother who grew all of our own food. We had about an acre of land in a small town, and so, of course, it was all organic. There were no pesticides, and we would go to the pier and get fish from the fishers, and we had our own hens and all of that. So I grew up with the idea that nature was totally abundant. And even though it was in the middle of World War II, we actually had a very good diet. We Brits had a better diet and were in better health during World War II because, you know, we couldn't get all of those bad-for-you sugary things. And so that kind of background really makes you into a systems, whole systems kind of person. And so when I finally arrived in New York in the 1960s, became an American citizen and all of that, I just knew that all of the air pollution in New York City at that time was unnecessary, and there must be something wrong with the way the whole economic system was working. And so we got to work on that, and I started a group with mothers in the play park called Citizens for Clean Air. And the first thing we realized was that the measurement system, the scoring system of gross national product, gross domestic product, was only conducted in money, and it was measuring basically a lot of the wrong things and not measuring what was happening to people's health, what was happening to the air and water. And, of course, that became rather a passion in my life and how I ended up joining up with the Calvert Group. And in 2000, we produced the Calvert Henderson Quality of Life Indicators. And now Calvert has happily given them to us at Ethical Markets, and they're now being rebranded and updated as the Ethical Markets Quality of Life Indicators. So I think that's enough, don't you?
Okay, very good, yes. So the one piece that I will throw in there is that, if I'm not mistaken, you did not attend college, and yet in your hunger for figuring out what was going wrong and how to fix it, you became an expert that has been published in academic journals and spoken at academic institutions, and I would imagine probably have some honorary degrees along the way.
Yes, I do. I have 4 honorary degrees now, and it wasn't that I didn't try, you know, to enroll in colleges in New York. I thought, my gosh, you know, I need to learn about how economics relates to ecology and biology and psychology, and of course, going around realizing there were no courses like that, I just thought, okay, well, I just have to go on, as my Buddhist friends say, laying down a path in walking. So luckily, I saved myself all of those student loans.
That's right.
And I didn't waste 4 years learning obsolete knowledge. And it turned out to be that I was sort of a guinea pig for the transition that's now going on in academia of transdisciplinary and multidisciplinary courses and research. Everything back then was in those little separate boxes, you know, marked geography and economics. And now, of course, we have to reintegrate all of that knowledge and connect the dots.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're saying that now is the wave of interdisciplinary and those sorts of things. But I would say, if the tide is turning, there's still an awful lot of invested academia in the old way. So this thing that you're talking about is not an overnight revolution. This is a slow process to get out of the silos and into teaching and learning the way the actual reality we live in works.
Exactly. And, you know, what's hurrying it along now, as you know, Terrence, is the MOOC revolution, in a massive online open courses, where basically, you know, even all of these fancy professors at Ivy League colleges are putting their courses online, and millions of students are taking their courses free. And so a lot of the students that used to go to their courses, you know, in person and try to find places to park their cars, now just take the course free. And when you realize that the next bubble that's going to burst in the U.S. economy is student loans, now over $1 trillion, and many completely unrepayable, and the default rate is about 11% now, so basically the whole model is broken.
Yeah, the whole academic model. It's interesting what you say. I don't know that we'll go in depth into the student loan situation, but at least when people, when they financed a house, the institution was looking at, well, we'll get the house if they fail. When you finance a college education, you know, both sides can end up with nothing. And there's been an article floating around the web actually recently saying that if we spent what we spend on granting to colleges, just made those grants pay for tuition, we could freely finance every public education student, that is, every public college student, for as much as we're paying right now, which isn't doing that at all. Let me just tell people, this is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally, speaking with Hazel Henderson, economist, teacher, creator of the television show and website Ethical Markets. Her next book is Mapping the Global Transition to the Solar Age. It'll be out in a few months. And you can learn more at ethicalmarkets.com or hazelhenderson.com. I want to go to one term that I've used a couple of times in describing you and just talk about a little bit. You've been called a futurist. Okay. Now, first of all, let me set you up just a little bit of background here. In 1972, 3 years after I graduated college, I was traveling the country alone in a van, and I went to hear Alvin Toffler speak, and he'd just come out with Future Shock. I was 23 years old, and I said, "This is interesting, Alvin." I went up to him after his talk, and how do I learn more? And he pointed me to a fellow named Billy Rojas, or Rojas, who was in a small college in Kentucky, and he said he has put together a directory, kind of an index of futurists. And so, you know, being that it was 1972, I got in my van and drove to Kentucky and knocked on Billy Rojas's door and said, "I'm here to learn about futurists." And he gave me this, like, 10 pages stapled together. Nowadays, this would be on the web, it would be automated, it would be viral, but you know, we're talking about at that point. Yeah. And so I then began to correspond and visit with futurists and kind of looked at the field. And as I look back on it, I'm going to say two things, and then I'd like you to comment on this. One is, it seems to me that this field has either been static or shrunk, at least in terms of attention and influence. And the second thing is being called a futurist a polite way of marginalizing someone or their ideas? In other words, that it sort of implies there's something not quite practical or timely about what they're looking at. Your thoughts about futurism?
It's very interesting, because the reason that I joined the World Future Society in about 1967 was because I was writing about what was wrong with economics. And I didn't want to be put into the left or right box. I was critiquing economics across the entire spectrum, from socialism all the way to free markets and capitalism. And so I thought it was much easier to call myself a futurist. And so that was really how that came about. And I met Alvin and Heidi Toffler at World Future Society meetings, and my big debut there was in 1975, where they, you know, they would have a meeting of futurists there at the Washington Hilton, and there were about 3,000 from all over the place there, and of course they were all men, literally. It was, you could count on the fingers of one hand the number of women that were there.
Yeah, you and Barbara and Marx Hubbard, right?
Just Barbara Marx Hubbard and me. Pretty much. And there was a lady from, you know, a futurist from Italy, Eleonora Massini. But otherwise, you know, that was pretty much it. And so at the end of this meeting, there was a lot of rumblings from people, you know, in developing countries. And they got together with me, and they staged a kind of intellectual revolt against Herman Kahn, you know, who was talking about thermonuclear war, and Jay Forrester, you know, from MIT, and all of these big shots. And so what happened was they kind of catapulted me onto the platform at the very last plenary. I had no time to prepare anything. And so I just sort of stood there and did a stream of consciousness thing, and ended up, you know, just getting a standing ovation, and I was completely freaked out by the whole thing. But that was my introduction to the world of futurists. Now, what's happened since is that futurism has kind of bifurcated in the following way. The people like me, who were normative futurists, who said, well, we want to look at ranges and scenarios and look at what we think are desirable futures. And then there was the techie trendsetters. And they just followed technological trends. And so they would talk about the future of the automobile, you know, because they had a contract from General Motors, or the, you know, the future of whatever. You know, electricity. And so there was always this big bifurcation, and the techie trend people, of course, were all consultants and made lots of money. And the normative futurists came out of, you know, they came out of sociology and psychology and much more of the behavioral human society spectrum. And that has actually continued. And I'm actually going to the current one, which is coming up in June, because it happens to be here near where I live. And that'll be the first time I've gone to a futurist meeting for about a decade.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to talk about my new book. So there is that. I don't know whether they're marginalized, but the corporate futurists have always done very well.
Mm-hmm.
But the more normative futurists, you know, have a hard time making a living like that.
Right, but the point that I was making, and I see what you're saying, the point that I was making was that when you're talking about, let me make one reference. As you were answering my question, I realized this goes back, calling yourself a futurist goes back to what we were saying a moment ago, was that when you call yourself a futurist, you don't have to say, I'm an economist, I'm a sociologist, I'm an anthropologist. So it's one way of getting out of the academic straitjacket.
Yes.
I get that. But what I meant was that when you're talking about climate change, or you're talking about water shortages, or you're talking about democracy in developing countries, these sorts of things. You're talking about things which actually have to be acted on today, and yet if someone says you're a futurist, it's like, we'll get to that, honey. You know?
Yes. The other way of looking at it is that current society, naturally, in current academia, because it's always about documenting things and everything like that, is always backing into the future, looking through the rearview mirror. You know, whether it's economics, or they all have to wait until you've got data. So that means you're always about 10 years behind, while reality is moving along its merry way. And so the best part of future studies is that you're turning around and facing forward.
Okay.
And even if you're only looking at scenarios, I mean, you know, that's what I do, look at scenarios and trends and see how those trends are interacting, and some may cancel each other out, some may amplify each other. And that got me into the whole complexity science thing, and yeah, that's what I'm really writing about in this new book. You know, all of those different methods of trying to map the global complexity that we humans have created once we decided to go global on this current very narrow model, which is the globalization of markets and the globalization of privatization, a very narrow form of globalization of technology, rather than what we could have done. We could have globalized human rights. We could have globalized environmental protection. You know,
we could have
globalized health for all.
Right. And what's interesting, of course, about the first two you cite, whether it's the environment or human rights and so on, those are the things which are truly global.
Yes.
In other words, there's no question about it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But all of those little boxes and all of that reductionist sort of scientific approach that spilled over into politics and, you know, congressional committees. There were 11 congressional committees on different parts of the energy, you know, agenda and all of those things, naturally led to this very narrow form of globalization based on the power of special interests in various legislatures around the world. And, of course, it was given a huge push forward in the 1980s when Ronald Reagan in the U.S. and Margaret Thatcher in Britain decided to deregulate everything. They called it the Big Bang. And so we were off to the races in this kind of private interest group form of globalization, where everybody who's powerful, you know, whether you're a big corporation with some technology or other, you were just free to go do whatever you wanted, whether it was, you know, GMO foods or nuclear power. And so the other forms of globalization, which we could have done, sort of lost out.
Mm-hmm. Lagged behind, for sure.
Yeah.
Okay, let me tell people again. I'm Terrence McNally. This is Free Forum. I'm speaking with Hazel Henderson. She's an economist, teacher, has a website and a television series, Ethical Markets. Her next book that she's mentioned a couple of times is Mapping the Global Transition to the Solar Age. And if that sounds, solar age, what does that mean? Well, really, what that is that's what's going to inevitably happen. And the question is, how are we going to make that transition? And you can learn more at ethicalmarkets.com and hazelhenderson.com, both websites. Okay, let me ask you one other question before we get into what I sort of said, which was these big issues. And that is whether you have communication and exchange with young people today. Are you able in your work to do that? And then let me set this up, is that it's my impression that the millennials, or at least a chunk of them, have a worldview that's more interconnected, more interdependent, more fluid, more dynamic, and so on, than the one that has certainly been prevalent in most of my lifetime, 50s, 60s, 70s, etc. And I'm hoping that this makes them more open to the kind of paradigm shifts and upstream root cause approaches that are going to be necessary for the breakthroughs that we need to turn things around. Are you in contact with them, and do you share my hopeful perception?
I definitely do, and I have always been in contact with young people. And it really began when my first book came out called Creating Alternative Futures in 1978. And what happened was I was invited by students that they would use their student budget, where they would normally bring in the Talking Heads, you know, or some rock band or other at that time. And instead, they would bring me onto these campuses, and I would be talking, you know, to 2,000 or 3,000 students at a time. And then they would come up to me after my talks and say, you know, we bought your book, and we put it into our library, and the professor of economics came and took it out and threw it away. So, and I have personally experienced that, you know, where student groups would invite me to give a lecture, you know, some named lecture in economics or science policy or something like that. And the professor or the academic committee would actually intervene and say, no, 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 we can't have her. She's too radical. And so I ended up with being really a Pied Piper to a tremendous number of young people, and that continues today. You know, they come to our website, and it's all downloadable and everything like that, and they say, oh, gosh, you know, it's like drinking from a fire hose going to your website, you know. And so we've ended up with a string of interns. And, of course, now, luckily, we're able to give them credit for their courses. So we generally always have a few interns from different countries. We have them from Brazil and from Sweden and from Canada and all over. And so definitely, yes, I find that about the millennials. We just love working with them. I mean, you know, I think of my grandson. He's 22, and he was, like many 22-year-olds, you know, really depressed because he couldn't figure out, you know, whether he was ever going to be able to have a normal life, whether he was going to be able to get married and have children, and where was he going to get any money. And so we made him an intern a couple of years ago at the conference that we put together with Janine Benyus, where we decided we should have a mind meld of having her scientists here and our financial people here, and we were coming up with what are now called the principles of ethical biomimicry finance. And so my nephew, Brendan, was here, and he was totally entranced. And he was just here a few weeks ago, and he said, you know, Hazel, that internship that you gave me, he said it was practically a religious experience. He said it's changed my entire life. Yeah. And it has, actually. He's going to be a solar contractor. He put the solar panels on his parents' roof. And he now knows he's going to have a brilliant future.
That's wonderful. I mean, it's about the big picture, and then it comes down to, in that case, one individual.
Yeah.
And it's all the same, really.
I love to hear from them, and you know, we get catch ups from them all the time. And so internships these days, they don't have to come and be in our space, you know, but we stay on the internet, and I will always give them like a one-to-one telephone call, you know, once a month or whatever. Right.
So anyone who's listening, who's interested in becoming an intern and working with Hazel on these things, go to ethicalmarkets.com, right?
That's right.
Okay. Okay, let's shift to that big conversation that I keep hinting at, which is, what do you think are the most critical issues currently facing the U.S. and the world? And then I may chime in with some of my own. But what do you think they are?
Well, I do think, first of all, it is getting the word out, really grasping the whole process of globalization, how to steer it in a humanistic direction, that there is no reason why we can't humanize, why we can't globalize human rights and globalize environmental protection and globalize health for all and all of those good things in Millennium Development Goals. And so that really is a key issue for me. And what's bringing it to a head, I think, is the conversation and the big fight over climate change and human effects on the planet. And I began catching that in the 1980s, where I was going on a scientific magazine, and I saw a computerized visual of space junk. I don't know if you've ever seen that, Terrence, but it was extraordinary that here is a planet surrounded by this enormous cloud of pieces of space junk. Anything from the size of a Volkswagen to the size of a paint chip.
Mm-hmm.
And only now are we beginning to face up to how are we going to clean that up. So if you want any more obvious picture of how humans now have affected the whole planet, not just with climate change, but with, you know, pollution and space junk and all these other things. And so grasping that we are now in this age of human effects on the planet, which some people call the age of the Anthropocene,
mm-hmm.
We have to now study this whole systems transition, which we are a part of. And that means looking at seven different levels of this transition. It's not just happening only at the climate level. It's happening at the level of governments, where we're having to look at how do governments pool their sovereignty so that they can be more cooperative. We have to look at global corporations. We have to look at the city level, now becoming very, very important with this new group called C40, which is led by former Mayor Bloomberg in New York. And we have to look at regions and local communities and the human family and the individual. And so this kind of expansion and integration of everything we've ever learned is now moving along very rapidly, and it's part of what I'm writing about. That if you look, for example, at what happened at Rio+20 in Brazil back last July, where you had 50,000 leaders from NGOs and civic groups from all over the world teaching politicians, who were still all in their little slots and silos. And they were coming there, you know, some of them were working on organic agriculture and clean food, and some were working on solar energy, and some were working on social equity. And, you know, this is the way this whole system transition is unfolding. And I wrote an article a few years ago, I called it Grassroots Globalism.
Mm-hmm.
Very different kind of globalism, always messy. I mean, you just have to look at the different aspects of the unfolding, what we call the Arab Spring.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them, you know, I mean, just like with our own revolution, it wasn't easy, and we ended up, you know, with conflict and all the rest of it. But eventually what I see happening is the awareness in more and more of our 7 billion human family, there's over 7 billion of us now, that we are one species among 300 other species that inhabit this planet.
Wait.
And we will all swim together.
Wait, you said 300. You mean, you said 300 other species.
Yes.
You mean,
at least.
Wait, don't you mean like 300, isn't there many more species than that?
Yes, I'm just talking really about mammals.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Good. You know, one of the things that you mentioned, you said even looking at our own beginning, I think people forget that the Declaration of Independence is in 1776, and the Constitution isn't until 1789. That's 13 years.
Yes.
And you know, I think what people remember is they kind of conflate the two dates and go, Declaration of Independence, war, Constitution, we're off and running. And in fact, it was a slow and messy process.
Exactly, and there were witch burnings and all kinds of terrible things went on.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. We're at the halfway point. Let me tell people that I'm Terrence McNally. This is Free Forum. I'm speaking with Hazel Henderson. She's an economist, teacher, as you can hear, someone who does not fit in any of the boxes, creator of the television show and website Ethical Markets. Her next book is Mapping the Global Transition to the Solar Age. We are talking about the big problems and the big potential solutions. You can learn more about her work at ethicalmarkets.com and hazelhenderson.com. Two different websites, both of those one word at a time, Ethical Markets or Hazel Henderson. This is Free Forum on KPFK, 90.7 FM, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, streaming and podcasting at kpfk.org. And for this week's conversation and many other interviews and articles, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, you can look into my work with organizations on their stories, narratives, messages, and so on. Go to my website, which is terrencemcnally.net, one word, TerrenceMcNally, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement, you can sign up there at my site, or you can email me at temcnally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, at mac.com. And you can also check out the Freeform podcast and subscribe to it on iTunes. You can check out Freeform with Terrence McNally on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. This is Terrence McNally. You're listening to my 2013 interview with Hazel Henderson, a homemaker with no college degree who founded Citizens for Clean Air in New York in 1964 and went on to become an influential economist, futurist, and author. She passed away May 22nd at the age of 89. Okay, so we've said globalization, but a shift of what we think of as globalization, as you said, grassroots globalization, integrating the human aspects into what so far has been, or at least the dominant force in globalization, has been multinational corporations and global trade. Global trade associations of multinational corporations, and what you're saying is that all the other aspects of globalization is what has to be filled in, and then climate change, of course, a global problem. It's interesting you mentioned space junk, and of course we know about the similar aspect in the ocean. So it's interesting when we can't see it. You know, it's bad enough to deal with pollution that we can see, the landfills, the air pollution in China and so on, what's happening in the waters of West Virginia right now. But when we can't see it, whether it's in space or in the ocean, then we really lag behind.
Right, absolutely. Well, you know, those gyres, these huge agglomerations of waste plastic that in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, apparently the size of Texas. And I had always thought, hey, I bet somebody at some point is going to put two and two together and realize that there are all of these very over-destructively efficient fishing boats that trawl and now are put out of service because they're destroying fish catches. And so the people who are the fishers who used to work on them, I bet somebody's going to figure out how they could go out to these gyres and begin putting them into those huge trawling nets and tow them back to the West Coast between Vancouver and San Francisco, where there are several waste-to-energy plants, and they could use them to create electricity. And sure enough, this is what I love about what I do, because, you know, we attract all of what I call the good news about the green transition. And a group in Vancouver got in touch with me, and they said, we're about they call it upcycling the gyres. And they are now in touch with a European group that is also working on ocean waste. And so really what I find is that every single solution to all of these problems that we humans have created is happening somewhere on this planet. And it's just that our communication system is so kind of set up at 50,000 feet, you know, and run by corporate advertisers, that we don't get to hear these stories. So that's one of the reasons I started Ethical Markets. You know, I wanted to say, hey, what we're going to be about is helping drive and accelerate the transition, the green transition to the solar age. And so this stuff comes to me every day. I sit at my computer 4 or 5 hours a day getting all this kind of good news.
Yeah, I was going to say that the what you were talking about, the top-down dissemination of information and connections, that still goes on, but that the internet provides the vehicle finally for all of these good news folks to find each other.
Thank heavens, yes. And so that's the other mission of my life, is to connect people who ought to be connected. So connecting the Gaia people in Vancouver with cleaning up the oceans people in Brussels. You know, and this is what moves the whole transition and accelerates it.
Okay. Now, you mentioned globalization and climate change. Let me ask about where does the global inequality issue fit for you in that?
Well, I visited that inequality issue many, many years ago when I was really looking for the first time at the design of the economy and realizing how it shut out a lot of the participants, not only shut out women whose work within the home was called, quote-unquote, uneconomic, because it was unpaid, but also it was going to, if we continued on that model, going toward automation and mechanization, then there would be increasing levels of structural unemployment. And so back then, in the 60s, I started a National Citizens Committee on Guaranteed Income.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole point I was making was, okay, I love the idea of technological progress. And I could see that we could have a leisure society where basically work weeks could get shorter and shorter and people would have more and more time because the new industries would be based on leisure, entertainment, travel, tourism, human development, learning to play the violin, all that kind of thing. And so that could create just as much of a booming economy of services as the current economy we had back then, which was manufacturing. And so basically I got together with Robert Theobald, who had written a book about guaranteed income, and realized, too, that Milton Friedman had the same idea, and he called it the negative income tax. And what it was geared toward was to say, look, you know, we are creating this cornucopia of goods and services from all of this automated economy, and the key issue is going to be purchasing power. Who's going to buy this stuff? And so there were many different approaches that we looked at. I worked with Lewis and Patricia Kelso about Kelso plans. In other words, if the machine was going to take your job, then you better own a piece of that machine. And that was their idea, you know, worker ownership and employee stock ownership plans. And then in India, the idea was, okay, everybody should have the right to a job. And of course, we saw how that played out. You know, if you go to India, whether it's still the same right now, but the last time I was there, you know, there's about six people at the airport that have to look at your passport, stuff like that. And so then the other was the guaranteed income, which was experimented a lot in the Netherlands in the 70s. And the whole idea was that, okay, people who were disemployed could do volunteer work and you know, develop themselves. And instead, what's happened now is that we've got this old economy still functioning on the old rules, you know, no worky, no ET, right? And yet we can't provide the jobs.
Let me
have an economy which is digitizing everything, as Jaron Lanier talks about in his book, Who Owns the Future? And we haven't thought about who's going to buy all the goods. And so if we don't do something about it, we will have stagnation, which Larry Summers has been talking about, but much more likely another depression.
Now, let's unpack this a little bit. In other words, that guaranteed income talk, if I'm not mistaken, Richard Nixon toyed with that. Am I correct?
He did. He had an experiment. Definitely. It was run out of a group in Princeton University called Mathematica. And you know what? Where it really founded? It was very interesting. It was on the whole Puritan ethic, the no worky, no ET.
No kidding. That whole notion that you have to work, that to earn your way to heaven, that you have
even if the society you belong to can't create jobs.
Right.
It's like with these students today, they'd like to pay off their student loans, but how can they do that if they can't get a job?
Exactly. Now, I also recall in the 70s, that was the era where, when one talked about the future, and I was, as I said earlier in the conversation, I was looking at a lot of these writers and so on. This was going to be our problem, was going to be a leisure society, not enough jobs. And yet what happened was, instead of that model spreading, what we got was women would enter the workforce. Now we've got more people trying to get jobs than before. And we still have the wrap. Then we ship jobs overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And so if one looks at America, everything went against that. In other words, and so, you know, it's interesting. And I'm just going to – this is a crazy question. You know, a lot of things that – it seems the answer to a lot of places where we took the wrong turn goes back to political choices that were made. The Powell memo, the move to sort of shift government to be the servant of corporate power in a way that it had been in the past, but in a way that just sort of on steroids. And then you look at, you know, tax rules, and you look at this and that, and you look straight down the line, and you see that it's come out of that. But I'm going to ask you, since you usually take a bigger picture view, how did we go so wrong? How did we see the problem and know that what we were running into was automation was inevitable, and so the issue was going to be purchasing power, the issue was going to be people having lives of meaning and worth? How did we go so wrong? And then are there sprouts now of hope for the future?
Well, yes. We went wrong basically because of the old paradigm, you know, the kind of no worky, no ET, free market paradigm. And basically, you know, it was immoral. If you didn't work, it meant that you were a layabout. You know, the idea that we had created a society of winners and losers, which was actually the fact, that was not in the paradigm. The paradigm said that any American could become president of General Motors, if you remember. That's what we were all taught. The
Work hard, play by the rules. Anyone can rise to the top.
And you can be anything you want to be, you know, be all you can be and everything like that. And so what happened was, though, that we still had a workforce, an economy that was structured so around the idea of a breadwinner and a family unit. And so that meant that half of the population was supposed to be kept out of the paid labor force. That was women. We were supposed to work free inside the household, and there was supposed to be a head of household. Of course, there was always a man who was going to be the breadwinner. And when women decided, hey, we don't think this deal is, you know, this was Betty Friedan in 1964. And so suddenly you had you had the civil rights movement, and people were saying, well, why couldn't we structure an economy where everybody could have a job? And so, you know, but mostly it was spearheaded by women going into the labor force. Mm-hmm. But of course, what that led to really was this shredding of jobs into lower and lower paychecks. And so we have the crazy anomaly now, you know, of while there's no jobs, you know, I think the last time I looked, there were about over 100,000 PhDs who are working as parking lot attendants and janitors. And at the same time, you've got entry-level workers who have to work two or three jobs. It's insane.
Yeah, definitely.
And so the restructuring of the workforce to deal with automation is now kind of job one. And as Jaron Lanier, his solution is, okay, we don't mind if we go on digitizing every sector of the economy and disemploying everybody that now has a job in those sectors, then the corollary of that is that what we have to do with Facebook and Google and Twitter and all of those companies is say, okay, what you have to do, your business model is taking people's information, personal information, which is very, very valuable, and selling it to advertisers. That's your business model. Well, if you're going to take this valuable information about me, I want to be paid for it. And so he's saying that we can easily create computer programs so that everybody gets paid for inputting any kind of information to Google or Facebook or LinkedIn or Twitter or whatever, because they're going to resist it like crazy. Now, the other solution, which I think is simpler, is guaranteeing incomes.
Mm-hmm.
And the good news on that is that two countries decided to go that route, and that is Mexico and Brazil. Mexico has the Oportunidades program, where they give guaranteed income to women who generally end up as the heads of poor households, as long as they send the children to school and to get them health checkups. The same kind of program in Brazil is called Bolsa Familia. And both of those programs, particularly in Brazil during President Lula's administration and continuing with President Rousseff, have brought millions of Brazilians out of poverty so that they can now afford to buy middle-class products and buy houses and cars and, you know. And so then the latest piece of news is a referendum in Switzerland, which was reported in The Economist last week, where they now have it on the ballot. There should be a guaranteed income for all Swiss citizens.
Yeah, no, all of these are exciting, but that appearance of it in Switzerland is the one that seems even more exciting, because it says then even old staid Europe is willing to look at this
In fact, it was always stronger in Europe.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I can remember going to a conference at Windsor Castle with Charles Handy, you know, who's the well-known mm-hmm. British author and consultant, and we had a lot of trade union leaders there. And I can remember we were talking, all of us technological enthusiasts like me, were talking about this wonderful leisure society, you know, mm-hmm. where the machines do all the drudgery and we can have 3-day work weeks and guaranteed incomes. And I remember at the break, one of these trade unionists comes up to me and pulled me down by the elbow. And he said, you know, you're all bloody mad. And I said, well, why, you know? And he said, well, don't you understand that the people with the leisure are not going to have any money? And I, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
You know, you're dead right.
Yeah, you don't call it leisure when you don't have any money.
No, exactly. It's terrible.
You call it leisure when you when you can afford to indulge it. Otherwise, it's just being unemployed.
It's just being unemployed. It's just terrible. But just to give you, you know, one more picture that you know very well of the irrationality of our current structure, workplace structure, is that you have all of these homeless people along with all these empty foreclosed properties.
Yep.
It's insane.
Yeah.
Now, I like what the city of Richmond is doing.
Yes.
With eminent domain.
This is Richmond, California.
Yeah.
Of course,
that makes sense. They're just connecting some dots.
Working class town, just north of Berkeley, and they're being it's a legal battle right now, but they are planning to use eminent domain to stop foreclosures. So it's the government actually working on behalf of their community instead of on behalf of their banks.
Can you believe it?
Yeah. That's the voice of Hazel Henderson. I'm Terrence McNally. Her next book is Mapping the Global Transition of the Solar Age. Her websites are ethicalmarkets.com and hazelhenderson.com. Okay, Hazel. Here's two questions, and you get 6 minutes.
Okay.
If you can stand in the future, I'll let you be a futurist again. If you can stand in the future, say 2035, 2040, right, 20, 30 years from now, and look back, did humanity turn things around? And if so, how did it happen?
Well, definitely humanity did.
Yay!
Because we are not terminally stupid, and we're learning incredibly quickly now because of all of this interactivity and social network and everything like that. And the reason we did it is because all of these green technologies, whether everything from organic agriculture to desert greening, using salt-loving plants and salt water, to all of the, you know, to energy efficiency, to solar, wind, geothermal, ocean currents, and thermal differentials. All of these technologies now are quietly growing, basically under the radar of the mainstream economy. And this is what we track in the Green Transition Scoreboard. The private investments that are quietly going on. Currently, it's $5.2 trillion. I'm just updating the numbers now, and the next one we put out next month, it will be well over $6 trillion. And so the path into the next human evolution is well underway. In fact, I think it's unstoppable. And, you know, when I talk to my friends at the American Sustainable Business Council, you know, and they say, well, gee, you know, they represent about 1,200 small sustainable businesses all over the U.S. And they say, well, look, what do we do with these 75 climate denier members of Congress? And I say, just ignore them. There is a wall of money coming at them from the other direction. They're just on the wrong side of history. That's all. And so this whole thing now is moving very fast. I get the evidence every day in my inbox, all of these deals going on all over the world. And so I think that by 2020, which is what we're projecting, if we continue with at least $1 trillion a year, as we have been doing for the past 6 years, we will, by 2020, have scaled all of these renewable technologies, and they will be cheap enough now to put coal, oil, nuclear, natural gas, fracking, and everything else, just put them out of business.
Okay. So, again, I've got you in the future, and you're looking back. So one thing you see is that the momentum of clean, renewable technologies was unstoppable, and the tipping point was hit, and things shifted to the slow death of fossil fuels and the continued build-out of the clean, renewable technologies. What about
Right. And the other thing that happened,
okay.
too,
okay.
is the phasing out of all of the enormous subsidies, government subsidies to nukes and fossil fuels. And every country now, 191 countries, have committed to doing that.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
Oh, yeah.
Including
so
us?
So that's going to make a huge difference. I mean, I think the renewables will win out even climbing uphill over all of those subsidies. But if you take those subsidies away and give that money back to the taxpayers, then, I mean, it's game over.
Okay. Now, what about the thing we were talking about purchasing power, about jobs, about human dignity? How did that change?
I think, basically, the whole paradigm of fear and scarcity, which we have had our politics of being dished up, you know, where it's all about fiscal cliffs and austerity and, you know, is that paradigm is being rejected. And it's going to be rejected because people will realize that we actually live in a world of abundance. And the abundance comes from the free photons from the sun every day. And all we have to do is to harvest them as efficiently as nature does in green leaves, which is what creates our food supply. And we're home free. And this is already happening. And the other kind of abundance is when we reorganize our societies beyond money, beyond the money paradigm, and we go back to real value and community. And you see this happening now where everybody is realizing that money is not wealth. There's no shortage of money. We create it. We see it being printed all the time on TV. It's just that central bankers, instead of doing what Milton Friedman said, which was go up in a helicopter and throw the money out so that every citizen can pick up what they need, instead of that, helicopter Ben Bernanke decided to throw the money at the banks on Wall Street, and that's where it all got tied up.
And that's where it still sits.
So once we realize that money isn't scarce, and that all of these local currencies and these alternative digital currencies are proving that every day, that's where the new social abundance will come from.
Okay, we got to close it there. It seems to me, as we go into this conversation with you, speaking from the future and looking back, that we uncover, you know, layers of the onion, if you will. And one thing that I will say, just sort of to sum up this whole approach we've taken, is that while we look at solving current problems, the systems approach to all of this actually says that hunger, water scarcity, pollution, malnutrition, all of these things, healthcare, education, all of the problems in them are actually related, and that there are underlying issues that's where the work really has to be done. And what I heard in just what you said, and you don't have time to respond here, was, for instance, the myths around money is an underlying issue. And when you mentioned that the U.S. is trapped with the combination of a Horatio Alger positive model and a Protestant ethic scolding model, that it seems that cultural change can hold back technological and human change, and that's another leverage point where things have to be shifted. And maybe that comment that I made earlier on that we agreed on, which is that the millennials seem to not buy those cultural myths the way that their parents did. We've got to bring it to a close.
If you want to watch the Money Fix. Have people watch the Money Fix on ethicalmarkets.tv.
Okay, the Money Fix at ethicalmarkets.tv, or they can get there from ethicalmarkets.com as well, correct?
Right.
Okay, the next book, Hazel's next book, is Mapping the Global Transition of the Solar Age. Comes out when?
February the 11th.
Oh, very good, very soon. And the websites are ethicalmarkets.com, ethicalmarkets.tv, and hazelhenderson.com. Thank you, Hazel Henderson. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Terrence. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Take care.
Very good.
Bye.
So for this week's conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, you can go to the website terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, the same website. You can sign up there also to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and a few articles with background on the issues. You can also get that email by emailing me at temcnally@mac.com, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y @mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. This program will be archived for the next 90 days at kpfk.org. Check audio archives, scroll down by date and time. Thanks to G, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi in production, and to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week when, if all goes well, my guest will be me. I look forward to it. I look forward to you listening to it next week on Freeform.